Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-1264 et al., BNSF Railway Company et al. Petitioners versus United States Department of Transportation. Mr. Monroe for the petitioners, Mr. Pinnock for the respondent.
Mr. Monroe, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Donald Monroe. I'm here for the petitioners. With me is Suzanne Kaufis of the Airline Pilots Association, and also present in the courtroom are counsel for 32 other transportation industry unions that represent millions of the employees that are subject to the rule at issue in this case. Before turning to the particulars of our legal argument, I would like to take a moment to emphasize just how intrusive the rule that we're talking about is here. Imagine what it's like to be subjected to this procedure. The subject is called into a room where she is required to drop her pants and her underwear, expose her genitals, turn around in a complete circle, and then urinate while that person observes her. Imagine how degrading and humiliating that would be. No court has ever upheld such a highly intrusive and offensive search of an American citizen outside the specific context of prison. This is the sort of rule that represents what Justice Brandeis referred to as an insidious encroachment on fundamental liberty and basic human dignity. It is neither permissible under the Fourth Amendment nor supported by the record in this case. And while there are two separate grounds for overturning this rule, the constitutional and the statutory, the two parts of this case do intersect. The department essentially concedes that it could not constitutionally require direct observation in all cases, at random, pre-employment, post-accident, and others. But it has failed to provide substantial evidence to support its decision to single out this particular group, return to duty and follow-up testing, as a disproportionately greater risk to cheat than the others.
Why isn't it enough, A, that they have been found guilty of drug use in the past, and B, that there's this new industry that didn't exist in the past that provides cheating devices, and there's testimony from experts which supports the department's conclusion that this category of drug users or drug abusers are likely to cheat? Why isn't that enough to both make the decision not arbitrary and capricious and to distinguish it from Uter?
The department itself admits that the rate of cheating that is going on is not simply a function of incentive, which is what their evidence regarding the rate of recidivism shows, but rather it's a function of incentive, means, and opportunity to cheat.
I don't understand that. I don't understand what you just said. I don't understand how that's responsive to my question.
Well, let me put it this way, Your Honor. Yeah. What the government has put in the record is evidence that the rate of drug use, the rate of recidivism, is higher in the return to duty and follow-up group.
Well, that's not all the evidence in the record.
Well, that's their primary evidence.
But
and then
that's
they go,
not all the evidence in the record.
No, they also
have testimony from experts, and there's this testimony about the and evidence about the cheating devices.
Yes, there is.
Right.
But if you look at each piece of that evidence, none of it goes to prove the essential question here, which is there actually a higher rate of cheating among the return to duty and follow-up population than these others, which they have decided is not subject to testing? But you don't have to take my word for it. The point that I'm making here
only people who've used drugs recently are going to cheat.
Right. Correct, but there are
the universe of people, of all employees, is a huge number. The universe of people subjected to the testing is people who've already used drugs. So I think it's fair to assume from that it's going to be a higher percentage.
Yes, Your Honor, that may be. The point is, though, that there are drug users in both populations.
By definition. But a much smaller percentage of all employees at issue as compared to a percentage of those who've previously used.
Okay, let's assume for the moment that rates of recidivism show a greater incentive among the return-to-duty population. My point about opportunity, in response to Judge Tatel's question, is made probably more clearly by this court in the Yorder case, where it says, on average, employees suspected of drug use may be more likely to cheat on a urine test than randomly tested employees or job applicants. It does not follow that drug users are more likely to cheat on surprise drug tests than on previously announced random tests or applicant tests.
But did Yorder have testimony from substance abuse experts like they have here?
I think actually the evidence of a drug problem may have been greater in Yorder than it
no,
is
no, no.
here.
No. I didn't say a drug problem. I said the testimony of experts about the risk of cheating.
Let me turn to the expert comments. They say that virtually.
You're right. That wasn't in the Yorder case, right? Was there any evidence in the Yorder case of an industry producing cheating devices.
Correct? No, Your Honor, there wasn't.
Okay.
The SAP comments at issue here, if you actually go and read them, actually look at what they say, they don't support the assertion that there is a disproportionately greater cheating among this population. For one thing,
they do testify that they're motivated to cheat.
Correct, but they say that all drug users are motivated to cheat. And our point is that the government has singled out this group rather than testing everyone.
She says, I'm looking at Peterson. Peterson. She says, those who have tested positive are a high risk for to conceal their conduct. She's talking about this class of people.
There are some SAPs who say that drug users, those who test positive, are motivated to cheat. Yes, but again, that doesn't say anything about whether this group is actually cheating at a higher rate.
But it's what the department is doing. This is a preventative program, right? I mean, the department is trying to issue regulations that deal with a problem they suspect is occurring.
Correct.
Right?
Yes, that's true.
They don't have the authority to do that?
Well, what this court said in Yorder was that the government has ample latitude to intervene before fears of harm are realized.
But you agreed that Yorder is different because of the testimony of the substance abuse experts here and not there, and because of the evidence of an industry that produces these cheating devices. Right?
I think that there was no APA challenge in Yorder, and so it wasn't, the argument that I'm making was not relevant there.
I see. Mm-hmm.
How about the fact that the industry itself is to blame here? In other words, when it was discretionary, and you painted a very stark picture of the process, and when it was discretionary, it wasn't conducted. And maybe that was because, you know, it was hard to find an employee who wanted to be a direct observer. That would also be a very unpleasant experience. And so they're now, and when you consider these people are in safety-sensitive positions, why isn't the Department of Transportation simply responding to the lack of implementation of the discretionary regime?
Well, the government assumes that the relatively low rate of direct observation in the industry to date is a function of employer malfeasance. But it is equally plausible to say that the reason why there are very few direct observations to date is because there are very few circumstances where individuals are suspected of cheating. The current rules are applied in any case in which an individual, there's actually reason to believe that the person may be attempting to evade the test, the employer is required to require direct observation, and in fact does. If you look at other cases in which that involve direct observation, the Byrne case from Massachusetts, for example, there is actually data in that case that suggests the same thing was true there. There are very few circumstances in which people are actually attempting to cheat. That's the reason.
How do you know that?
Well, the small number
you don't test, you don't know.
If they're successful. If they're successful.
I mean, if you don't check.
Well, the fact of the matter is that if you...
I don't think you can speak definitively to that one way or another.
Well, there is data that's discussed in the Byrne decision about what the data is on the rate of cheating. And people do get caught. I mean, not every person who attempts to cheat is successful.
True, but a lot of people who cheat presumably don't get caught. At least that's, you know, that what the experts believe, what GAO studies suggest. A lot more evidence than was present in the early 90s in the cases we had then.
Again, I mean, there's no data about the success rate in this industry. None.
Ultimately, your argument seems to be even if this is marginally better at detecting cheating, it's just too outrageous to permit this kind of procedure.
Let me put it the way that Judge Henderson did in her dissent in Wilner. You have to compare the marginal additional value of this test against the increased intrusion. And given that you already have a regime in place that requires direct observation in any case in which cheating is suspected, what you're talking about here is a rule that requires direct observation in cases where cheating is not suspected. And the value of that is de minimis compared to this highly invasive procedure.
The military's done this for a long time, correct?
Yes, they have.
Is that permissible in your judgment?
I think that the Fourth Amendment reasonableness test is highly contextual, Your Honor. I mean, that's something the Supreme Court said over and over again. I think I would have to be presented with more specific facts about the military context to be able to say specifically whether it is or it isn't. I will say that the Cheney case...
Aren't these the people at issue here, particularly if they failed the drug test once, which is by definition who we're talking about, in similar position to military people in that they're in safety-sensitive positions just as military people are?
I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, if I may. This court is clearly bound by the Skinner decision's proposition that these individuals have reduced expectations of privacy. They do not have, however, de minimis expectations of privacy, as the department has asserted. And in Cheney, which I think addressed the court's question, you had a situation where, as in all these other cases, they acknowledged a reduced expectation of privacy given their governmental status. But the key fact, the reason why the testing was approved, was because it did not involve direct observation. And in case
what,
after
what
case,
would just to go back to my question on the military, what would distinguish safety-sensitive bus drivers, pilots, train operators from members of the military?
In terms of their expectations of privacy as to where they fall specifically on the spectrum, I suspect that they're quite similar. There's no doubt after Skinner that we're in the lower half of the spectrum, and as to precisely where they fall above or below military, I think that's really a judgment call.
Can I ask you another question? Would a pat down be permissible as an alternative in your judgment?
I think that in many circumstances a pat down would be less intrusive. Yes,
than less than intrusive.
Less intrusive.
But that involves physical touching, then.
It would depend on the context and how the rule were designed and the circumstances in which it was used. I think that the general standard is that when you're talking about any form of testing that requires some sort of physical touching of the employee or this kind of visual observation of genitals and other private areas, you're into a very dicey area under the Fourth Amendment.
One last question. The discretionary program that existed before was constitutional in your judgment?
We're not challenging it, Your Honor, yes. I'd like to save time for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
Mr. Pinnock.
May it please the Court, Mark Pinnock of the Department of Justice. I represent the respondent of the Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation was faced with a daunting and serious challenge to the integrity of its drug testing regime. The advent of this new multi-million dollar industry devoted to one proposition, and one proposition only, beating the drug test. That threatened every part of the drug testing regime. But the Department of Transportation adopted a limited and measured response, focusing on only on those individuals who have already demonstrated an utter disregard for the public safety. And those are the individuals who have already tested positive or refused a drug test. These individuals comprise roughly 0.2% of the total population subject to DOT mandated drug testing. 0.2%. It is addressed to individuals.
That doesn't mean that the search, that doesn't mean that it isn't intrusive with respect to each one of those individuals.
Correct. I would agree. We're talking about out of roughly 12 million individuals subject to DOT regs.
Wait, does this balancing you're doing, does that have anything to do with the First Amendment analysis at all? The fact that there's only a small percentage of the people that have, not First Amendment, their Fourth Amendment rights are less because there's few of them, proportionally?
It goes to the point what the independent of that privacy interest is. Yeah. And the privacy interest of these individuals is, in our view, de minimis. And here's why. Not only are they in an industry that's already have a diminished expectation of privacy by virtue of being heavily regulated, that's the Skinner case, but they have already failed one test and are thereby disqualified as a matter of law from occupying a safety-sensitive position until they undergo a highly intrusive rehabilitation program under the supervision of a substance abuse professional. In that rehabilitation program, drug testing, including direct observation drug testing, is the rule rather than the exception. This is voluntary. No employee is required to do this if they elect not to resign.
If they want to keep their job.
They can do a non-safety sensitive position.
It's not voluntary in that sense.
It's not voluntary in the sense of that, but that's as it should be. They've already demonstrated a willingness to put the public safety at risk. So if they want to put the public safety at risk again and be in a position to do so, they're going to have to demonstrate the onus is on them that they have stopped using illegal drugs. And there's no question here, and petitioners don't challenge it.
Did you say that in their rehabilitation program they all are subjected to direct observation?
That's the rule, Your Honor. It's not required, but that is, in fact, the practice of most SAPs to do direct observation drug testing during the rehabilitation program.
And does the record... Is there record evidence that that's done in most cases?
There is. Some of the comments of the SAPs suggest that. I can't give you the percentage of it. The SAPs' testimony or comments suggest that they typically, or often some of them at least, typically recommend that employers upon return to duty and follow-up testing also employ direct observation testing. It is the Department of Transportation.
Would this regulation require direct observation testing in the rehab program?
It does not. It's at the discretion of the SAP.
Why would the department make that distinction?
Well, because we rely very heavily on the expertise of the drug substance abuse professional, because those are the people that have the hands-on experience with these drug abusers. Mm-hmm. They believe, and that's why it's normally the practice rather than the exception in which direct observation testing is employed. Mm-hmm. I can't give the court percentages. I don't have that data, and it's not in this record. But it wasn't really contested below either. The point on this is that, and this goes to Judge Henderson's question, that upon return to duty, the recommendations of the SAPs, and this is in the record, has been ignored. We have a tiny percentage of direct observation testing being conducted by employers. And the reasons are articulated by the amicus. The employees don't like it. That's got nothing to do with the recommendations of the SAP. It's got nothing to do with whether or not there's reasonable suspicion, whether the employee will continue to use drugs. We have collective bargaining agreements and management union understandings that preclude the employer from exercising his discretion. These are items that we have become aware of. Now, this isn't in the record, but if we had a remand, it would be down. It's not in the record only because it's not disputed. They're not using it. The percentages are tiny. On the maritime industry, the direct observation testing for this class of employees is less than 1%. For the motor carriers, the guys that drive the big rigs, 1%.
That's still a lot of people.
It's still a lot of people, but it's very.
Is there any
very
case that's ever upheld frontal direct observation?
Never had there been a case where we have the same group of employees involved. So the answer to the question is no, but there's none of the cases involved this sort of situation. So this is DOT's response to a situation that demanded a response. DOT does not have the luxury of sticking its head in the sand and resting on the existing drug testing regime, which is utterly unresponsive to deter and detect the existence of these types of cheating devices and substances. We cannot detect synthetic urine. Can't find it in the laboratory. It passes. Without the kind of intrusive regime that we're asking the court to approve in this case.
That's not really the question, though. The question is whether the previous observation regime would allow you to detect whether that was being substituted?
The answer is no, and that's in the GAO reports that show that, in fact, you can easily pass these.
It's hard to know.
Well, DOT tried. GAO tried, and they actually were very, very able to adulterate and use synthetic urine in laboratories and
wasn't the problem in the GAO report that some of the observers weren't doing their job even under the old regime? That was seemed to be more a critique of the personnel than of the regime.
Yes, and we're always going to have that problem. But the GAO report also, and this is on pages 15, 16, 17, and other places in all three reports that we cite, they were able to substitute synthetic urine in sites that were doing everything in compliance with DOT protocol. We can't catch it. And the employees know we can't catch it. The deterrence value is lost. You mix that in with the situation where the employers are simply ceding away their discretion as a product of union and agreements and desire not to offend their employees. You have a completely untenable situation for employees who have already demonstrated their prisoners to their drug use by virtue of testing positive in the first place. You have expert testimony in the form of comments by SAPs that demonstrate that these individuals are highly motivated to do so. It's a game. Beat the drug tests. Heck, I Googled it this morning, and I got over 7 million hits on just that. I also Googled the Wizinator. There's a new improved version out. You can get it now on sale for $139.95. Took me 30 seconds to get to that site. This is a crisis proportion problem. We don't have the luxury of simply ignoring it. And to the extent that DOT has adopted a very narrow approach.
DOT could just not allow people who fail the drug test to be employed again in the same safety-sensitive position.
That's one option, but that's one option that Congress has barred to us.
Congress has?
Congress has mandated that these individuals be afforded, at least so far as the regulations are concerned, employers can do so if they wish, an opportunity for rehabilitation. So they get one bite. Now, in the aviation industry, if you test positive twice, you're barred for life.
In the other industries, if you're tested positive twice, you're still not barred, right?
Well, that's at the employer's discretion. The DOT regs talk about this. Many employers have two strikes and you're out policies, where if you test positive, you're out, period, at least for that employer. Now, it's not an industry-wide ban. It is for the aviation industry, but it is for that employer. They're fired. And part of the problem that person can then go off to another employer and simply not reveal his prior drug testing. But that problem can be addressed to the extent that we have employees who are going to be subjected to the intrusive level mandated by this. Of course, it's intrusive. But I wish to stress something here. These are two separate regulations. And stand and fall on their own separately. You could sustain 67B mandating direct observation testing and still strike down 67I if you found that too intrusive, and vice versa. But the rationale for making
Why do you need I if you have J?
I'm sorry, J?
J is the you must watch the employee urinate into the collection container. Why do you need the preview if you're going to actually be watching the main show?
The short answer to that is the Wizinator, Your Honor, and other substance. You can watch the Wizinator and not know it's the Wizinator. And that's the nature of these kind of devices. They are designed by very clever people to pass a direct observation testing that's already in place. That's why this current structure doesn't work and cannot work. Now, it's utterly plain to me that unless you have something to meet that, then the whole effectiveness of your Rehabilitation Act, of your rehabilitation efforts, fails. Employees are not motivated to undertake true rehabilitation if they know that they can meet the drug test. If they know they can go back to the office and keep, or their employer, keep the Wizinator or something handy and put it on whenever they're called to do a drug test. There's always a time period between being notified and being directed to the outside facility which actually does the collection. It takes only a minute to put these things on. You said
they go back to the office. Now, how broad is the safety-sensitive position?
It's not an issue.
I mean, I assume they go back to flying planes and driving trucks and so
driving
on.
Trucks or driving but trains or flying airplanes.
What do you mean by going back to the office?
Well, I don't mean just office here in a sense. There could be a safety-sensitive position, like, for example, a private police officer who carries a weapon. He may occupy an office. He may a train driver may have it in his lunch pail or in his pocket. These things are small. The adulterants that can destroy a drug test can be concealed in a vial the size of a quarter. That's in the testimony of David Stevenson, the director of the HHS in the 2005 testimony before Congress. A quarter. Can't detect that. Unless you require the kind of intrusive search, and of course it is intrusive, required by 67I. You're not going to be able to deter the use of these substances until everybody understands, the drug abusers understand, that the odds of them getting caught are higher than they are now. This market exists for a reason. These are private entrepreneurs. They wouldn't be offering these products if they weren't being used. And they are being used by the very fact that it's increasing use, just as demonstrated by the testimony on the Hill by David Stevenson and by the GAO report. The numbers are proliferating. DOT has acted reasonably to try to put a stop to that. But it really has no other choice if this drug testing regime is going to continue to have any sort of deterrent effect on these employees. And I leave the court with the idea that what DOT has done here is exercise its expertise to make a prediction. We have a situation where we have drug users who are highly motivated, who can successfully cheat. We have made basically a safety prediction that these employees especially are more likely to use these sort of cheating devices. It's the same sort of safety assessment that was at issue in Public Citizen versus FAA. In that case, this court gave the utmost deference to that safety assessment. And that situation was whether or not the release of certain security information would place the public at a safety risk. It is DOT's considered judgment that, in fact, that's exactly what will happen here if these regulations are struck down. We have already had a situation where this court's injunction pending appeal has persuaded HHS not to adopt the same regulations at issue here for return-to-duty employees. The power of this court is such that HHS was deterred from doing so.
I think how long the military has been doing this?
The military has been doing it since the Vietnam War. This is nothing unusual what we're doing here. This is the same procedure that the Olympics use, except there is even more intrusive. You have to drop your pants down your ankles in that situation and raise your upper clothing to above your shoulders. This is nothing unusual. The NCAA does this for drug testing athletes. A complete kind of revealing of the clothing, dropping the clothing so as to detect these devices. Everybody understands that these cheating devices are here. Everybody understands you have to take aggressive, intrusive methods to address them. This is nothing new. This is the standard methodology for, in fact, addressing the use of these devices. Otherwise, they could be easily concealed and readily used.
Why not do it on everyone?
Well, because the expectation of privacy is different for everybody. We don't have the same incentive to cheat for a reasonable suspicion. Employees are random testing for employees.
But you know, year after year, a certain percentage of employees cheat. I mean, test positive, I should say,
well,
use drugs.
Or the random testing is 2 to 4 times less than these individuals, and nobody disputes that, by the way. They also have.
If there's one bus accident, that's, you know, the people who lose their lives in the accident aren't going to be.
That's true. And that's true. And one can imagine any kind of scenarios where that would happen, and they happen all the time, unfortunately. What DOT has tried to do here is address the worst aspects of the problem. We are constrained, of course, by the decisions of this court, which are, you know, binding on us. So we're trying to address the situation to the best we can. Is it ideal? No. Is it a good first step? You bet. I thank the court.
Thank you. Mr. Monroe, have? All right, why don't you take 2?
Thank you, Your Honor. 0.02% of 12 million employees, if my math is right, is 24,000 people. So the idea that that's somehow de minimis is I think, absurd. Second, counsel's reference to Google, I think, is revealing. That's essentially the sum and substance of the government's proof of the use of the Wizenator in this industry. They can find it on Google. They don't have one example, not one, in this record.
Well, how are you
going to
get
being caught with
one? I said the same thing again. How are you going to get an example?
Well, again, I mean, people are caught with.
Unless someone says, after the fact, you know, writes a book and says, by the way, I used a cheating device to get by the person when they were standing behind me. Unless you have something like that, you're never going to have the proof that you're talking about. It's all going to be kind of predictive judgment.
Isn't it also pretty obvious that, I mean, counsel just said, you know, hey, these people are out there trying to make a buck, and they wouldn't be making Wizenators if there wasn't a market for them. Someone's using them. Who's using them?
The fact of the matter is that while you can assume that there is use of the Wizenator, there's no proof of it. And I respectfully disagree with the court. I think that people are caught with these devices. But the government hasn't shown that any rail or air or mass transit or
pipeline. No, but you don't know that everyone who's used them has been caught. That's the key.
Right. All I'm suggesting is that they haven't shown one example of someone being caught with one, not one. As to the question of the expectation of privacy and the government's assertion that it's de minimis, the only circumstance where that a court has found that you can have this level of intrusive testing is when people are incarcerated. No court since Bell in 30 years has extended that beyond the walls of a prison. And as with respect to...
Has any court rejected it in the circumstances we face here?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so. The Piraglu case.
Which one?
Piraglu in this circuit involved an EMT. While there's no discussion of reasonable expectation of privacy in that case, I think it's beyond dispute that an EMT, much like a firefighter or a police officer or any other government employee, would have a reduced expectation of privacy. And the difference here between the military and the NCAA context and all of those is that you have a statute in which there is an express congressional recognition that there is an expectation of privacy and requires the government to respect it to the maximum extent.
You're not relying on a statutory argument.
No, what I'm saying is that
that can't be used to distinguish those cases, can it?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that Congress has recognized that the expectation of privacy in this industry is not de minimis for Fourth Amendment purposes.
Well, his point was that his point, I think, was, and I'm not sure whether he's right or not, but his point wasn't that. His point was is that these are people who not only are working in safety-sensitive positions, but who have violated the drug rules, who have used drugs. And so that's his point.
And what he
and Congress hasn't addressed that group of people. Congress has said that people in the industry don't have a de minimis privacy interest, but Congress hasn't addressed itself to this subgroup of people.
What counsel leaves out of his distinction...
Isn't that right?
No, Your Honor, because what counsel leaves out of his description is that this is not just the group of people who have violated the rules. It's a subgroup of that subgroup. Rather, it is the people who have been tested positive and then have been through a government-mandated rehabilitation program and have been certified as drug-free by a government-approved SAP.
Well, then how come you're not objecting to any drug tests after the rehab program?
Well, the industry has accepted since Skinner that...
No, I'm just asking about your position. I mean, your position sounds like you would oppose any drug testing, any random drug, any drug testing that's other than that any other employee has.
No, Your Honor. The industry's position...
You just said they're certified as drug-free.
Correct. But,
so
but
why isn't your argument they're just like any other employee now? They've been through the test, that's it?
Well, Skinner recognizes that any employee in this industry can be tested.
Right,
what we're saying...
Employees have to have six tests in 6 months, right?
Yes, that's
okay,
correct.
Okay, so that's not true for other employees.
No, Your Honor.
So why isn't your position that even that's unconstitutional?
Because it's the intrusive nature of this particular form of testing that tips the balance.
See, once you acknowledge that this group is different, which you just did, by acknowledging that they could impose more testing, more random testing on them, then you're in the realm of second guessing where the agency drew the line.
Well, I respectfully disagree. The difference here is that the Fourth Amendment is a balancing test. And at some point, you tip the scale from reasonable to unreasonable. And it is the addition, I think it's close to the line to say that the people who have been certified as drug-free can be tested over and over again. What tips the balance, what pushes this over the line, is the intrusive nature of the direct observation.
Okay, and just so I understand your position, your answer to the... to the availability of cheating devices is that what's missing in the record is evidence that any particular employee actually used one, right?
Not just that, but that there's any evidence of
suppose there had been evidence. Suppose there was testimony from one of these professionals that she observed someone using a Whizinator. Would that make it not arbitrary and capricious and constitutional?
Well, it would make it more likely that I would be here just on the Fourth Amendment, Your Honor. I think that the government's obligation is to put in substantial evidence to support the conclusion that this particular group of individuals is cheating at a higher rate than the others. And they haven't even attempted to do that. All they've said is they test positive more often. They're two different things.
All right.
Thank you.